Now, the kind of the contrast between your own personal raw way of doing art and just like getting it out there with the illustration work, the facetasm that you did with Charles Burns, mm-hmm. he seems like it's quite the opposite, where he works to kind of get that perfect black.
Oh, yeah. Well, Charles Burns kicks ass as an inker, you know? It's just, I'm really lucky that he'll bother to hang out with me and ink with me, you know? But he really, sometimes, a lot of times I'll do a pencil sketch, but I finish it when I'm doing the inking. He really makes a really good indication of where the line's going to be. And so sometimes when we're collaborating, he'll ink the real lame stuff I've penciled and have it finished for a joke and laughs at me. But he's really fun to watch. He's a really good guy.
Has he been influential in your own work?
Well, I think we're real sympathetic spirits in a way. I think that we've both had for me, my heavy ink line thing probably comes from Jack Kirby as much as anything. And his ink thing probably comes more from EC Comics.
Mm-hmm.
So we probably meet at Feelstein or Johnny Craig or something like that.
One question I had was about Jack Kirby in particular, from one of my compatriots in the comics criticism field, asking about the influence of Jack Kirby, and I guess at some point you had some interaction with him?
I went to see him one time. When I first moved to L.A., I had read somewhere that he lived in Thousand Oaks, so I looked up in the phone book. I got, Thousand Oaks information, and he was listed. And I called him up and asked if I could come visit him, and he said yes, but he had accidentally invited me on Thanksgiving. And so I called him back and said, "You really want me to come on Thanksgiving?" And he said, "Oh, I'm glad you called me back. I was in trouble with Ross for inviting fans over on Thanksgiving." So I went a couple of weeks later with my friend Justin Carroll, who has a design agency in L.A. now. And he was just great. He was just Jack Kirby, and he didn't have any tricks up his sleeve except that he was just a genius. His drawing table was just a simple table, and his pencils looked like regular pencils, and he didn't have fancy anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a page on the table that was kind of being drawn diagonally from the left down to the bottom or something, kind of half-finished page of something. And anyway, they were nice. There were lawn chairs in a swimming pool at the bottom of the pool and a whole bunch of sand because they were out there in Thousand Oaks, and I think the wind blows like 100 miles an hour out there.
I was thinking he was probably having some kind of crazy rock and roll party, maybe.
Yeah, maybe so.
Throwing chairs into the pool.
Maybe some sentient apes came down and partied.
On their odd robotic machines.
Yep.
So you were a kid of the Kirby comics.
Yeah, and especially, after I was in college, when he did all that DC stuff, I guess I was in college and out then, but I liked his stuff from Fantastic Four and Thor and stuff in the late 60s.
Well, it seems like, especially in your Jimbo, the Dante stuff, the little, machine he rides on is very like that Kirby-esque.
Yeah, he's just a real simple volume. Kirby would put more reflections and a dark shadow in the core of everything. Definitely, I'm not above being influenced as much as possible. Jesse Marsh, a whole bunch of people. I like a whole bunch of people, but Kirby was just really where he got to in the late 70s was pretty amazing. If you could stand it, some people can't stand it.
You're meaning the DC stuff, or
yeah, the DC stuff. A lot of people don't like it.
That's my favorite stuff.
Yeah, me too.
I don't. Some of the monster stuff's neat. I really don't like Stan Lee very much. So that.
Hey.
Sorry.
I got my Foom card right here in my wallet. Fans of old Marvel.
Uh-oh.
No, I enjoyed that when I was 14.
Mm-hmm. But to look back on that, it seems like the fourth world stuff is where he was really trying to stretch beyond and kind of push his stuff further.
It was really exciting, and it made the 7-Eleven kind of like a 7-Eleven in your dreams, because one dreams about, I do, about going to newsstands where there's unfamiliar publications and new astounding publications. And Kirby was changing titles so quickly, it was kind of like, oh my God, there's a thing about demons.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's Devil Dinosaur, and it was really fun.
And then 2001.
2001, and the Jumbo 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And the Captain America with, like, the full, you know, all the splash pages and so on. Yeah, it was great.
Seeing his kind of output on work, does that kind of drive you for yourself to be able to maintain, not so just in comics, but in all your endeavors?
To be energetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to match a guy like that, but I look to, yeah, a lot of the people I admire, like Eduardo Paolazzi, I'll always mention, the forerunner of English pop art, the pop art movement. And he didn't paint, but he did everything else. Did textile designs and silkscreen portfolios, sculptures, collage, writing.
Is that part of your decision to move to New York, was to get into the other aspects, like, because it's such a versatile art scene?
Yeah, I guess I considered moving to New York early in the 70s after college, but it seemed too scary. And after I finally had it with L.A., though I really loved L.A., but it was time to move, then that seemed to be the obvious place to go. And it worked out.
Did you have a lot of interest in the New York scene at the time, of some of the artists that were painters?
Well, I kind of felt like I arrived late for that scene in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt like I'd get a part of the early 80s scene, I guess, maybe.
That's what I'm wondering. Like,
yeah.
I'm not the most knowledgeable of that scene, but like the stuff like Basquiat I was working on and things like that.
My stuff was very much like Basquiat before, you know, maybe 4 years before he emerged. So I could have had some influence on him, but basically it was kind of a crowd I might have fitted in with. I don't know. But I followed this kind of path where I've gotten to, I mean, Basquiat and Herring are dead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm alive and I have a grown daughter and I'm still making, and I'm making light shows with Joshua White, you know, so I'm alive.
It's quite tragic, actually, from that scene.
They didn't really get to mature. They did this incredibly focused work for a few years in this giant burst. I mean, like the robots in Blade Runner, you know. And but then you didn't get to see what would come next.
I remember seeing this thing with Dennis Hopper on TV. He's a big fan of that whole scene of art, and he's going through his own personal collection, and he's like, everyone he's pointing to, all their stuff, they've all passed away.
Yeah, no, it was a really bad time. And, you know, heroin's always a bad time.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it may be really fun, I guess, but it's always, I don't know, I just see it kind of eating people up.
If you know your music scenes, I presume, so you know probably Vancouver's history with heroin.
Yeah.
Let me change the gears a little and ask about music stuff, because you've worked with The Residents.
Yep. A little bit.
Behind some curtain.
Well, The Residents produced that first single and recorded it and then added some tracks to it, but mostly they made me play it, and my friend Phil Culp played bass on it. And then I did some packaging for them on like Submod and various packages, but I was never a resident.
And that was for Ralph Records, right?
I think they referred to me in some songs, you know, which was kind of pretty unreal. But and I visited them up there, and they were super great, wonderful people, and they're still great, wonderful people.
And he also, Frank Zappa.
Yeah, that was like, I'm still a a Zappa fan, but I never got to meet Frank because I did the unauthorized covers accidentally instead of the authorized covers. But I'm a fan of Cal Schenkel, and when I first moved to L.A., I looked him up, and he was real nice to me and showed my stuff to Frank, and he said that Frank did not seem to be very interested. He was really into Bruce Bickford and the animation. But then one day I got a call from an ad agency, a design.
Mm-hmm.
And they hired me to do the cover, but I just kept wondering why I wasn't meeting Frank Zappa. And finally, when I was working on the third one, I asked, and they said, oh, because we're just putting these on the market.
Oh.
Great. Oh, boy. There go my chances of meeting Frank Zappa.
Yeah. I've just signed myself away to something I don't want to be involved in.
Yeah, but I did, you know, since I was trying to impress Frank Zappa, I tried really hard to do good covers, and Matt Groening told me that he liked my covers, so, and when I did the Ryko disc extra illustrations, I got the entire CD catalog, so I listen to Zappa all the time.
Now, in the back of the two Dante books, I think both of them, I know one of them does, do both of them, they have your recommended music?
Yep, they both have 33 recommendations, I guess.
So, what role does music play within your own artistic process?
Well, I make music. This year, in 1982 or so, I made an album for a Japanese record label of my psychedelic country music. And and it never came out on CD, but it's about to come out on CD this year, sometime this year, with a Freak Flag. And Devin Flynn, who does Y'all So Stupid on Super Deluxe, and I have been collaborating on music for the last couple of years, and Ecstatic Peace is going to put out a little CD by us this year with a Freak Flag. And so, I don't know. I like making music. I'm not super talented at it. No one asks me to play guitar at a party or anything, you know.
Why didn't you sing for us?
Well, come on. Pick up that guitar. But when Devin and I performed in Brooklyn last year, we actually went over okay. And so that was just that little bit of encouragement. Just, you know, it's something people shouldn't do is encourage me about music.
And that's, you're saying that's kind of a psychedelic experimental, like kind of along the lines of like Captain Beefheart and stuff like that, or
it's pretty primitive. I end up writing songs. I kind of always think I'm just going to do abstract music, but it often turns into songs. And working with Devin, he just pretty much let me play anything and then built things on it, and we built more things on it, and it was real fun because I play trumpet and badly and guitar badly and sing pretty badly. So it adds up to a psychedelic wonderland that's not to be missed. Devin's great, too. Sorry.
Well, it's neat, the role of music, because I know Baron Story, I don't know, are you familiar with his stuff at all?
What is it, just him solo or with a band?
I think he does his, I don't know his music so well, but from what I can understand, it's very, like, heavily influenced from, like, Karlheinz Stockhausen and John Cage.
Oh, yeah, I love that stuff.
And things like that. So it's interesting seeing like artists like yourself and Barrymore. You're both very different, but you're both kind of have, I guess, like that common like primal feeling to her.
Yeah, I don't know. I just get excited about a lot of modern art, a lot of it, whether it's music, poetry, or whatever. A lot of it's horrible and uninteresting, but the good stuff's really exciting. And Stockhausen, you know, he's done some bummer records you wouldn't want to listen to. Oh, mm-hmm. No. He's running around in a pasture blowing a horn and throwing gold dust at a cymbal. Why did I buy this record? You know? But then 10 years later, it sounds good.
Yeah. And then he, you know, has a student named Holger Zschokke. And
yeah.
I'm a big fan of the Kraut Rock stuff, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm lately listening to the Technicolor Web of Sound on my iTunes because it's just kind of like 60s psych pop 24 hours a day, and I've discovered bands like the Blossom Toes and Secondhand, and bands I didn't know about, but Krautrock is good.
Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a resurgence, I think, in like that old 60s psychedelic stuff, because I know Genesis Bjorge, going back to another person, yeah. He's really retouching on that kind of roots too right now.
He's been referring to it forever. You know, his Brian Jones fetish is just, you know, didn't
unruly.
Sound so much like it. But it's really exciting for me, I guess, that music that I still get excited about from the 60s that some young people are interested in, because it could be totally forgotten. But and also, I guess people are still alive and doing stuff. I'm a fan of that band, the Lilies, not the Tire Lilies, but just the Lilies, and they just sound kind of like the Kinks or that kind of pop or something.
I think
they do.
I had a guy on a couple of weeks ago and we played a song by them.
Oh, so very sunny pop mm-hmm. stuff. Not normally what I listen to.
Well, that's the neat thing is going through the music catalog. Like I see a lot of crossover and stuff I'm interested in, and it's a lot of that like really dirty sounding, like I guess post-punk type of feeling. Is that...
I always like records that have a big sound to them, whether it's psychedelic music or, say, like, there was this record, Rima Rima, that was some kind of obscure record that came out in the 80s that just had a big, giant sound to it. And, say, like, the band July, the psychedelic pop band, you know, they're really, like, it's just total whimsy. Kind of horrible whimsy, but the sound is nice and big.
Or, Nurse with Wound has their own amount of odd whimsiness, too.
Who does?
Nurse with Wound. I see you got that.
Yeah, that's true. They do. Creakiness.
Yeah. It's, I like all that old stuff. So it was nice, you know, reading this book and going to the end and, you know, seeing mentions of Birthday Party and, you know.
That early stuff was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. It's, he does some good stuff. Now,
you know, knowing stuff like, so recently I tried to listen to, I got some like free records, you know, from a record reviewer friend of mine, and it just sounded so highly disciplined. It didn't sound raw anymore.
Yeah, well, like, you know, Merzbow?
Yep.
Like, he was really primal, like that rough, like just angry, you know, it's obviously this guy sat down with a bunch of gear and just made some, you know, whatever subconscious sound he could come up with.
Yeah.
And he's got a laptop now, and it's just not that, doesn't have that same, I guess, vigor.
Yeah, it was very vigorous. I was interested in hearing his version of I Am the Walrus.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
I haven't heard it either. He's collaborating with someone, I'm not sure who.
Well, like something like White House kind of has that emotion, too.
Yeah. Well, being friends with Savage Pencils, you know, he, with Edwin Pouncey, the writer for The Wire, and he's a really on top of, he reviews most of that stuff for The Wire.
Ah.
Everything noisy. Jazz Camera.
Don't know that.
Yeah.
See, there's so much stuff to know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I know very little, but I happen by it by way of friends, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that I knew Claude Bessie, that was the editor of Slash Magazine, and Matt Groening and Richard Gere, all these people that, like, really, you know, they're trying to stay ahead of each other. Byron Coley is a great, you know, gee whiz.
Yeah. plastic that melted and the chromium too. Who are the brain police?
Now, the question about music is, do you utilize different stuff when you're working on different things? Like if you're working on, you know, one of the purgatory pages, you want to listen to something that kind of really goes with that page?
Not necessarily. Or is it just, it's just more like, can I have something on or off now? And sometimes if I'm being paranoid, it's like, well, I better listen to Tintin Winds to see if the world ends. To see which way to work, if I should like drop the pen and run for the car.
And that's one of the things I was reading. I don't know if it was in the monograph. In satiroplastic.
Yeah, I think so.
Now,
I've taken it from an old play, you know, and modified it, so I don't really know what the original pronunciation is.
I just thought it...
Satiromastic became satiroplastic.
Well, it has that kind of 21st century, I don't know, disposable sound to it.
Yeah.
That was done during 9/11, and that kind of that impact on you, I'm curious about that. In like your way of addressing it through your work?
Well, it totally, completely scared the hell out of me, and I went into mourning for a couple of years really heavily. Kind of like the Hiroshima strip in a way.
Mm-hmm.
If you see, just seeing what happened on that day very clearly from the rooftop in Brooklyn, you could just, you know that this building was going to be falling on a million people for 20 years, you know. And it still is. It's falling on people every day all over the world. And, you know, so it really upset me. Also, that I'm kind of a paranoid and a cartoonist, I can think up nefarious plots, you know, all day long. And I just thought, gee, if someone really doesn't like us and they're kind of smart, it's like monsters in a monster movie if they could run fast. You know, you want monsters to go slow.
Yeah.
So you can make it to the pickup and get it started.
The zombie movies.
Yeah. But anyway, you just had this idea like, oh, they disappeared the World Trade Center in 45 minutes. Ooh, gee, you could probably get rid of all the buildings in Manhattan, you know, if you got one a day. And so, you know, it's kind of like anything could happen. It was a monster movie, but with really high consequences for a lot of people.
What you just said about your own imagination of you know, what could happen with things, it's interesting. I think the some government thing hired a bunch of spy writers to kind of get the most outrageous concepts.
Oh, that's a
and
good
prepare
idea
for them.
It's a really good idea, and also it'd be a good idea to kind of watch recent movies. You know, just watch some action movies, and I don't know, it's kind of hopeless. You know, we're just like completely primitive cavemen here, you know, for quite a while to come. Pretty uncivil.
Well, that kind of brings me up to something you're exploring, I think, in Cola Madness, is the cargo cults.
Yep.
In, in the South Pacific.
Yep.
I didn't even know about them until a couple of years ago, and someone described to me, I guess, people, you know, indigenous people on these islands get these, you know, American supplies falling out of planes and see those as, I guess, religious idols.
There's a whole history of it, just starting with trade between mechanized societies and primitive societies, you know. Like,
mm-hmm.
What are you to make of a wristwatch, you know, if you've never seen a knife and or something, you know. So yeah, it was very interesting for me. It was like metaphorically just totally related to like being raised in a really fundamentalist Christian religion that seemed like that to me, you know. Really,
what kind of if you don't mind me asking, sect of Christianity?
Well, in every southern town, there's two or three signs outside of town that say, "Welcome, the Church of Christ welcomes you to, you know, mm-hmm. Butte, Montana," or whatever it is. And it's that church. And basically, it's like George Bush's church. It's everybody's church. It's pretty average. It's the average church that believes they're right and everybody else is wrong.
That born again.
That's what it is. And I kind of was really, you know, traumatized by it when I was a kid and had to think my way out of it and then be, you know, kind of angry about it. Never kind of got... When the World Trade Center falls down, people like, religions like this don't get together with the other churches in town and pray, you know.
No.
Because they don't think everyone else's prayers count. So, I don't know. It's just a lame-ass way to go through life and... You know, so I could be critical of it and other stuff that bugs me. That's one thing. Being a cartoonist, then you've entered into the realm of satire and a cultural commentary, really. And that's where I can air stuff like that.
And that's kind of the role that Dante's work played.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know why he wasn't killed for it. I don't understand really like how he was kind of protected or what. I might be wrong. But it seemed like he created such an amazing propaganda device for the Catholic Church at the same time actually criticizing it and deviating from the dogma. It's kind of like this amazing trick somehow. You know, I don't understand what it really might have been like back then.
Well, it's even like in that within the core characters, Virgil. Like, I haven't actually read Dante.
Uh-huh.
I'll be honest. But I know some, you know, a little here or there, you learn... Through time.
I didn't know anything about it until I read it, you know, really, except those cartoons of hell. You know.
Mm-hmm. The, were they woodblock prints?
Oh, just like any kind of, you know, Jimmy Hatlow, any cartoonist who's done hell, they kind of make it like Dante's Inferno.
Mm-hmm.
So Jimmy Hatlow's Inferno. But I think what you're referring to was like Virgil leading this the Christian Dante,
yeah.
The pagan Virgil.
Yeah, you know, who was a, you know, noted scribe of, I guess the Roman version of the Iliad.
Yeah, in the in the Aeneid.
Yeah,
Aeneid.
The Aeneid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I've actually read. Also.
Yeah, so I've read those things. I don't retain everything at all.
No.
You know, I've read everything that I like footnoted in that Jimbo book. I read it, but I couldn't like be really brilliant about all that stuff. But, yeah, and Dante did all kinds of things, criticized popes, like kind of complimented his homosexual teachers, put himself in the company of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the greatest poets of the earlier ages, and did all these crazy, audacious things. And somehow, they didn't, like, chop his head off.
Thankfully. Now... What did you have in mind, like, when you started doing the Dante, I guess, adaptation? I don't know if adaptation is the best word, but the, you know, did you read it, or was it something you kind of, like, had, saw that would be interesting, and then decided to read it?
I had named that book Jimbo in Paradise, and then kind of realized, cool, this is a book I haven't read, and so I decided to start reading The Divine Comedy. And when I started reading it, I realized, oh, wow, here's this guy who's, which I knew a little bit about, you know, just a tiny bit about it from, you know, my education. But well, here's this guy following this girl. And I'm at a point in the story where Jimbo is following these girls and he's about to enter this giant-like complex that's like a mountain. So there was always already kind of a synchronicity. And so I just pushed it. I just like, okay, this is a fascinating architecture. I'm just going to climb on it like everybody, other idiot. And I mean, purgatory is really a mosaic. It's not going to be very satisfying to anyone except people who love to read all of these books that are listed, and to people who might like puzzles, or to people who might just like poetry and associations.
Well, it's a very challenging book.
Yeah.
And it's I found it fascinating because it seems within a page, one that stuck out to me in was the one with Alice. I think it was with Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
And you have like two things going at once. You know, there's what he's saying, and then there's what Jimbo is saying, which are kind of going together, but not like separate threads within themselves.
And it would also be echoing what was happening in the canto. I would only be doing that if Dante were speaking, and then whoever he's speaking to were speaking in that area. So that's one thing I did, was I mimicked specific action. But then I had this like system of kind of like, you know, it's just kind of this. Purgatory was kind of a systematic book. It's not very sympathetic to the reader in the way, except I want it to be like neat to look at, you know, have a cool reading list, recommend some records in the back. But it's not, you know, it's not like reading Nancy.
When you did Inferno, you did first, right?
Right.
And as an issue of the Jimbo from Zongo.
That's right.
Were you originally going to end it there, or?
No, what had happened was I'd decided a long time before that I really wanted to do a quarterly comic because I hadn't done many comic books. So I started drawing a quarterly comic as simply as I could, and I was reading Joyce at the time, and there was this whole thing in Ulysses about the complexity of the writing changing and then style being, and so I just thought, okay, I'm going to find, and it was just a concurrent thing. I'm going to risk the welfare of my family and try to draw, you know, a quarterly comic book and see what happens, but I'll try to draw it really expediently and then tighten it up as I go, and that'll be part of my game plan. In every issue, it'll be a little tighter. So by the time I'd done a certain number of issues, I realized that I could not keep tightening it. It was not popular. It was not making me any money, except, you know, my friend Matt Groening was lovely enough to print it and pay me for it and everything. But it just wasn't economically feasible, so I just realized, okay, I'm just going to push the idea of making it more complicated and more, and have stylistically evolve somehow, and just take the amount of time it would take to do that. And so I've done two steps, and now I have to figure out whether I've already done it with it. I could just not do it because I did Adventures in Paradise, or I could try to, like, you know, reapproach Paradise again. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to take me. I'm going to have to live 500 years.
Only so many hours in the day.
It'll take a while, and I'm not sure exactly what to do or what form it should take. Should it be a bigger book, finally?
Can it be bigger?
Can you get it in your house?
Well, are you doing anything for the, not to sidetrack, because I actually got more purgatory questions, but in the note of big book, are you doing anything for the next Kramer's book that's coming out, Kramer's Ergot?
No, as far as I know, I'm not. I've just been now I'm involved in this big monograph coming out, and then kind of endless events that are going to go along with it to promote it and sell the
like this.
Like this, and like going to Chicago and talking to Chris Ware, and going to California and having a public conversation with Matt Groening, and programming a night of movies at family.
Oh, at their theater.
Yep. And boy, that's going to be a boring night for everybody. I hope they'll show up. It'll be good.
I heard Kim. I talked to Kim Deitch, and he said it was the most fascinating time, and he got to do his silent movies at the theater.
That would be wonderful. But they have to be silent. I'm going to have to learn something. I'll have to, like, well, I know about the 1925 version of Lost World. That's about it.
Chaplin?
Yeah, I like that. But I'd have to find, you know, I don't know.
That horse stuff we're talking about?
Yeah, Muybridge, something like that. Maybe Leger's experimental films or something. I don't know.
We've got about 30 minutes of film footage there for you.
Well,
now Purgatory, working on that book, did it take a lot out of you personally doing
it's really hard. You just think you're going to die. I don't know if every cartoonist is like this, but it takes me a long time. I mean, even like if people think I can't draw, I still have to draw it 50 times and erase it before I ink it, and it takes a long time.
Well, it's quite different than the rest of your stuff because it is so elaborately done.
it's elaborate, but I'm sure it drives people crazy that the anatomy of Jimbo is like totally quirky and fucked up a lot, you know? And some of it, like, I just left in there on purpose because it was so retarded, and sometimes I was trying really hard and couldn't do it. Sometimes it worked out.
It's, you know, going back to stream of consciousness, right? Yep. If you put it in there and it works for you.
Yeah, well, there's this theatrical thing that you can do in comics, you know, where the monster's behind Jimbo, but he's facing the viewer with his arms out towards the viewer, fighting the monster behind him kind of thing, you know. That happens in my comics a lot, where you don't necessarily see the back of Jimbo's head when he's fighting a monster on the other side, away from you.
It's deciding where the fourth wall is.
Yeah, it's just like fooling around with it so it like works within whatever happened at the moment.
Now, the literature within Purgatory, how verbatim of what you use is in there? Is it what you footnote on each page?
Yeah, well, those, I'm not going to put anything on the page that I haven't footnoted, and they're not all verbatim. Sometimes I've introduced puns into them. Sometimes I've collided a couple of things together in the same passage. A lot of times it's just a verbatim, but sometimes a verbatim quote, and sometimes I've shortened things because of the amount of space in the balloon or the meter or something.
Now,
which is totally chopping everyone's stuff up, I realize.
Well, you know, I was talking about Burroughs earlier, and
collage.
The collage and the, you know, the cut up, stream of consciousness, is that something for you where you kind of throw whatever you can in there and see what comes out?
Yep. Well, Donald Barthelme said that, I don't know how to say his name, but he said that the genius of today, the most important tool is scissors, because it's the time of collage.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, scissors are obsolete now, but it was a really telling comment 20 years ago.
But you don't do any computer stuff, do you?
I scan things and I send them to people in email, but no, I don't.
I got the one thing from you, the excuse me you sent as an attachment.
Mm. Well, I can scan things and put them in there, but I can't manipulate them.
That's good, though. There's something I like about the whole tangibility of art.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the computer tool is making people's work a little bit uniform in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Any medium will do that. But since the computer's ubiquitous, it's not like there's etchings and block prints and stone lithos and all this kind of stuff. It's all computer printout, pretty much, or on something. So I don't know. I teach in the graduate school at SVA, and my students are super talented, but there is something that they share because most of them are working in Photoshop.
Mm-hmm. No, it's something I've noticed with a lot of cartoonists that I really like is you can kind of see the elements of Photoshop can play. And I know Peter Begg, I interviewed him, and he was just like, since he started using Photoshop, he's been a lot sloppier with his own art. Just because he knows he can fix it later.
He can tweak it in Photoshop.
He can put the lines where he wants them to be.
Wow.
Which kind of saddens me.
Well, I really like the artifact, and I like the human hand, and I like the trace of the human hand.
Well, it's interesting, like, watching people draw and just seeing how they do that and what kind of movements they do.
Yeah, it's really hard to get a control of your hand and make it do what you want it to do and then find the tool and figure out the mark it wants to make and the direction it wants to go and get really in the groove with it. So I'm not really ready to give it up. Of course, I know probably a stylist might feel exactly the same, but I don't know. Yeah, I like mixing the gouache and dipping the ink, spilling the ink.
Seeing what comes out.
Yep.
Now, what do you teach graduate students?
Well, this year I'm taking David Sandlin's class, and it's an illustration and painting graduates studio class. So I'm kind of like there. I go once a week, and I do some sort of presentation, and I bring people in to speak to them, and then do crits as a group and individually talk to them. It's from like 5 till 11 at night or something.
It's a long class.
Yep.
I'm in school right now. 1 hour is enough for me, but I'm not doing art, so I'm just doing boring history stuff.
Well, but yeah, no, it takes more time.
Now, sketchbooks, what kind of role do they play in your daily life?
Well, I don't draw in a sketchbook every single day. I probably draw in something every day. And there were years that I just drew on loose pieces of paper for a while. But mostly since the 60s, late 60s, I've been drawing. As soon as I discovered empty books, I thought they were neat. And I discovered rapidographs, and I thought they were cool. So I've been continuing that all these years. And I could put down, I've done books that are really tight, like they want to be some kind of book of their own and could be reproduced. And then there's just books that are diaries and day books and books that are commercial art and so on. And nowadays I just try to dump everything in them.
Do you kind of, I notice, you know, I was mentioning earlier the reoccurring things from the sketchbooks to the paintings.
That's really how it works. It really, I find these images and then I figure out which images might be able to work in paintings, and most things won't work in paintings, and then I take those little elements and then make drawings of them separate from the sketchbooks, and then I might make collages from photocopies of those things, and then some of them want to be paintings.
Do you ever revisit things that you've painted in the sketchbook form?
Oh, yeah, I use elements over and over, and I would even go back and use the same drawing to do another painting. Usually I keep moving ahead, but I don't. I will do that sometimes. Like, I'm not through with this image. I'll go, I'd like to do it a different color or something.
One thing, going through all the paintings in the book, you're quite a, you know, prolific in the amount of, I guess, styles and mediums. Do you try and kind of keep pushing yourself ahead and trying new stuff that you haven't tried before? Or is it just you have an idea and a concept and that medium will work best?
Well, I really like the idea of extending the idea of play in what I do. And if there's something that I feel like, gee, in school, I always thought we were going to build a polyhedron out of toothpicks. You know, so I might spend a few years building polyhedrons out of toothpicks. Or if, you know, anything I do is not dangerous or hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, I know you can, like, make a head out of kids' modeling clay and make a two-piece plaster mold and pour latex in it and make a puppet head. Or if I want to make polyhedrons or tetrahedrons or whatever, then I just think of some really simple way to do it. Right now I'm making stuff for my show and the Aldrich Museum in a couple of weeks, and I've got this big giant thing hanging off the ceiling that's made out of chopsticks and soda straws and tape and pipe cleaners. It's very impressive looking.
That's something you were doing in your art show too, wasn't it? Was utilizing, like, I seem to remember pictures from the book.
Yeah.
Where you'd use the, no, I'm not going to say the name of the structures because I can't, you know, my art knowledge isn't
geometric,
that good.
You mean geometric figures?
Yeah. Something Buckminster Fuller would have liked.
Yeah, that's what they are. And basically all they are is you make a triangle and then you tessellate it. You add more triangles to it and then you add more triangles to that. So you're basically adding a layer of triangles every time you can in an organized fashion, and then you find that there's these structures that grow, and then you can take out the center and extend the shell, and you could change the axis of them and change the thickness and the spikiness and so on. So I learned stuff like that. I learned kind of primary stuff about how things group together in nature or just structurally, and then it'll end up being handy at some point.
Is that part of the reason you did the light shows, was just to kind of play around and just see what you can do with things and seeing what the...
It was following something that was fascinating, you know. I just had never seen a halogen lamp before, and I hung a mobile in front of it, and it was all in sharp focus, and I went, wow, I better go get something colorful, you know, like a color film and put in front of this. And before I knew it, I was making a giant mobile with a bunch of halogen lamps in my studio, and that was kind of like the first beginning of the light show. But I mean, it's stuff like that since high school, since, you know, I wanted to be a hippie.
Well, you're doing puppet shows and stuff in art school, right?
A little bit. My senior painting show involved a puppet show called Godzilla Gets a Hot TV, and it was a bastardization of Bunraku puppets. And then after I graduated from art school or college, I had a performance band, Ape Week, with my friends who I went to school with, Jay Cotton and Rick Heidsman. And we did puppets and comedy and music and stuff. And then we all ended up working for Pee-wee later.
And did he, like, it was pretty early in when Paul Rubens was kind of creating the Pee-wee character. Had he seen your puppet work, or was it?
I think he had only seen my graphic work, album covers and my comic strip, and you know, I don't know if he'd seen it himself or if other people had shown it to him. I don't really know how he came across it, but he liked it, and he really always, like, supported my vision. And, you know, I tailored my vision to what he's trying to accomplish, but he's always been really supportive and try to include me in projects and stuff. And we're still trying to do stuff, but it takes a lot of meetings to land big projects.
As a kid growing up, like, I'm 29 now, so, like, when Pee-wee was out, I was the right age, and I was, remember as a kid, it was just, like, the oddest, most demented thing on TV. It was just like, what is this?
Good.
Was that part of the fun of working in such a constricted environment?
When I was a kid, I just thought, boy, if they would listen to me, I could really do something, you know. I could make an amusement park. If Disney would just hire me, I would go crazy, you know. And so doing the Pee-wee show was kind of like, it was exactly like that. It was like, wow. And it was also, I was a hippie first. And the hippies were always, man, if they would just like turn the media over to us, we'd blow their minds.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've read my fair amount of Abbie Hoffman stuff. So.
Yeah, and so this was like a hippie show in some ways. Like The Simpsons is secretly a hippie show.
Yeah. My dad, he's kind of, he expected the show to be canceled within the first year.
The Simpsons?
Yeah. He was like, how could something so outrageous stay on TV? So he obsessively taped them all, expecting that it would be...
He was right. Well, he was right that it was powerful, and that it's on Fox shows how powerful it is, because it's the antithesis...
Of what they are.
Yeah, of what they are, but it makes them so much money they can't, like, stop the voice of hippiedom that's Matt Groening.
How has having him as a friend really pushed your own work?
Well, I don't know. Matt's really, you could just tell he's kind of a power. I think we're similar in that we wanted to do things. And he always, I think, wanted to do things on the scale he's doing them. You know, I kind of intended to do things maybe a little bit bigger scale.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also kind of pacing myself in a way. So maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I won't live long enough or something. But I don't think I could ride the thing he's riding at all. I don't think I would. He can handle. He's great. He can handle it. He's brilliant.
But, it takes a temperament.
Yeah. Yeah.
Upcoming work. You have the book coming out from Picture Box.
Yeah.
The monograph, as they call it.
Yeah.
for life.